these scales are something you do need to use a microscope or something to find the scales. Okay? The scales might fall off sometimes, and the fish might lose its scales. Okay, if the fisherman called the fish to be scaled, and if, to be from the category of scaled fish, that's enough. Okay.
I see. Okay.
Yes.
I'll ask the second question that crossed my mind after the break. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Welcome back to the program, Islamic Laws on Iran Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Well, Sheikh Javid, I promised our dear audience actually to ask one of the other questions related to your words before the break, and when you were talking about the halal marine animals or sea animals. Let's say you mentioned that, for example, if you live in a non-Muslim dominated area, like, for example,
non-Muslim
areas, right? Like, for example, the Indian subcontinent that you gave as an example. You said that some meats, well, are not available in the market. You don't have the beef market, and they don't allow it there. So it's safer, actually, to go to the sea market and find some scaled fish over there, right?
Right.
But do you have to investigate how the scaled fish are caught? Because we know that, you know, the fish should be out of the water and they die in the dirt, for example, out of the water.
Yes.
And if they are caught, for example, in nets or caught in another way, which they die in the water, that would not make it halal for us, right?
Yes, you're
so
right.
So what about this? Do we have to investigate, for example, how they catch the fish?
Well, the same question can apply to fish found in Muslim country and in a Muslim country.
In the Muslim countries, so you give the benefit of the doubt.
You give the benefit of the doubt.
Because they are Muslims and Muslim. They know the rules.
Yes, you're
but
right.
But in the non-Muslim areas, you can't give it the benefit of the doubt.
Do you have
to keep investigating about it?
You are right. The thing is that fish are generally caught in large numbers.
Yes.
Okay? And the fisherman does not kill the fish inside the water with something. Okay. They are usually, and for example, in 95% of the cases, the fish are brought out and they are let to die on the deck of the fish or on outside the water.
Right.
So that's why for that very strong probability, we are allowed by the Sharia to eat the fish that are sold in the non-Muslim market, be that Muslim non-Muslim market, a Christian non-Muslim market, or a Hindu non-Muslim market, it is okay to eat the fish that has scales.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's take a break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws. Stay with us.
اللهم صل على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio.ir with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. and just to be our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javid, somebody asked us, my father died and I don't know if he had any khums here or not.
Hmm.
Is the inheritance from our late father subject to khums? In other words, does the individual have to pay or should he pay the khums on the part of his or her father?
You know, generally speaking, according to all religious scholars, inheritance is not liable for khums. You know, it's not necessary to pay khums on what an individual inherits from his father, mother, or any other relatives.
Mm.
Okay, there are different possibilities. Okay, if, for example, you are not sure that he owes khums,
yes,
or his property is subject to khums, you do not have to pay khums because you're not sure. But if you are sure that your father used to pay khums and he failed to pay khums from the property you have inherited or the asset that you that is available now in his bank account. In this case, because you're sure, you must pay his debt to khums like his other debts mm-hmm. at first and then, of course, distribute the rest among the heirs. That's the point.
Okay. If the first income of the new year occurs with a time interval after the end of the khums year, can the beginning of the new khums year be set as the date of the first income?
Religious authorities, as far as I know, has permitted their followers to change the date of the khums according to the according to their first income
mm-hmm.
and whenever it is convenient and it's possible for them to pay khums, like for example if they want to change their khums date from the 1st of Muharram to the 1st of Rabiul Awal or from the 1st of Muharram to the 1st of Nowruz according to the Persian calendar
mm-hmm.
so it is permissible. And His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khomeini also maintains that there's no problem in shifting the date of khums to some other dates.
I see. Well, Shostakovich, what is the duty if one doubts whether khums is due on the capital with which he earns his living or not?
If the original capital is from his income and no khums has been paid on it, it is subject to khums at the end of the khums year.
Mm-hmm, I see.
And of course, it is not obligatory to pay khums. It is khums in the following cases, according to His Eminence. Number one, if after paying it is khums, the income earned by using the rest of the capital is not enough for living expenses. In this case, it's not obligatory to pay khums. And then number two, if after paying his khums, the business to be managed with the rest of the capital is not compatible with his station as per common people, or he doubts whether this is the case or not, in this case, khums is not payable.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on iranradio.ir with me, Muhammad Javad, the host of this program. We bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو رحيم محيي المميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو
Palestine Declassified.
Hello.
I'm Chris Williamson. This is Palestine Declassified. We're the only show that's dedicated to investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's show, we'll be investigating the Nabad movement that was founded around 7 years ago. They claim to be a movement of British Jews that was seeking to end the Jewish community's support for apartheid and Israel's occupation of Palestine. But on closer examination, Nabad's noble claim seems to be rather far-fetched, as Latif Abu-Chakra will explain in our first report.
Nahmood is an organization in the UK which claims to be anti-occupation. However, further examination of its background raises serious question marks about its function within pro-Palestinian circles. Founded in 2018 and only open for Jewish people to join, Nahmood has been welcomed by the Palestine Solidarity Campaign on national marches. On the Nahmood website, it makes it clear that Zionists are welcome in the organization, stating, Jews who identify as Zionist and non- or anti-Zionist are welcome in our movement as long as they adhere to our goals and values. We do not define ourselves as an anti-Zionist movement, as we want our work to focus on striving for dignity and freedom for all. The website then reiterates, we place values over ideology. For that reason, we welcome Jews who identify as non-Zionist, Zionist, or anti-Zionist, as well as those with no views on Zionism into our movement, and also work with a range of allies. The organization even goes further to state, Nahmood does not take a position on Zionism, BDS, or borders. The mysterious group also states that anti-Semitism is and has been evident on the left as well as the right, and we commit to challenging our allies and partners when required. This was clear when, in 2021, Nahmood backed up the Israel lobby group UJS in its vicious campaign against Professor David Miller at Bristol University, stating on Twitter, the language used by Miller surpasses truthful commentary on Israel and employs several conspiratorial anti-Semitic tropes. Of course, Miller was later vindicated, and this was all part of a Zionist lobby ruse to push him out. More question marks about Nahmood's actual position on these essential issues come up when we consider that in 2021, the group held an event at the Limud Festival. The CEO of the festival was Eli Ovitz, a reserve captain in the Israeli military and former spokesman for the genocidal occupation forces. The Limud Festival is also funded by arch-Israel lobbyist Trevor Shin. In a Nahmood Facebook post promoting the event, the group stated that it was looking forward to the participation of the Abraham Initiative's organization. The Abraham Initiative claims it exists to increase synergy between UK and Israeli bodies and agencies, and is funded directly by the Israeli government. Why would Nahmood be embraced by the Palestine Solidarity Campaign?
As usual, I'm joined in the studio by David Miller, who's the UK's foremost scholarly critic of Israel and our resident expert. He's a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch and a senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. And joining us again as our guest contributor today is the lifelong anti-racist socialist and founder of the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mick Napier. Mick is the only Scot certified free of racism by two Scottish law courts after successfully fighting off Zionist lawfare tactics. Welcome to the show. David, I mean, holding events at a festival where the CEO's a former spokesman for the Israeli occupation forces and a current reservist, I mean, it rather blows the gaff, doesn't it, on the mod? I mean, why would they do that, do you think?
Well, it does blow the gaff if the gaff hadn't already been blown some years before. I mean, it's position saying that there might be some members of the organisation who are Jewish who don't have a position on Zionism is just clearly ridiculous. I mean, it's an attempt to bring into the Palestine Solidarity Movement those who are soft on Zionism, who maybe think of themselves as being non-Zionist, and to undermine support for resistance in Palestine. That's the clear attempt. They don't even think that there's a problem with the occupation of the Golan Heights by the Zionists, because that's not Palestine, apparently. Mm. So this is a soft Zionist attempt to infiltrate the Palestine Solidarity Movement, and it seems to have been very successful. And of course, what happens in points of crisis is that they line up in support of openly Zionist lobby groups, which of course is unthinkable.
Indeed. Well, Mick, I mean, Namanda also states that it's open to Zionists, as David was just saying that. I mean, that's an impossible circle to square, isn't it?
Well, a lot of people square impossible circles. Apparently 40 or 50% of British people think the British Empire was a benign operation. But look, it may have been possible in the early stages of Zionism for the hardcore ethnic cleansers, Labour Zionists and also the predecessors of Ben-Gurion and Smitrich, to have a few people to decorate their movement who believed you could dispossess the Palestinians and colonise them with sweet words. But that's in the past. Today, Zionism has evolved into a genocidal movement, and there is no other element of Zionism that's significant beyond that genocidal dominant component. So to try to say that you stand for any semblance of human rights, but at the same time you will involve in your movement people who support the smashing of Palestinian surgeons' hands in order to prevent them from doing operations, the genocide that we see unfold, that's quite impossible. I mean, we've had examples in the past of people who've tried to say, well, I'm not anti-Zionist, I'm just a non-Zionist. But what would you do, you know, during the struggle against apartheid in South Africa for somebody to say, well, it's not that I'm against white supremacy, I just don't have a position on it. It's absurd, bizarre, and a moment's reflection tells you that it's just not going to fly.
No, indeed. And David, what do you make of Namad? I mean, forcefully you know, criticising the and condemning the Palestinian resistance.
Well, it's a red flag, isn't it? I mean, as soon as you hear something like that, you know that what the agenda is to oppose resistance. Of course, it's the right of the Palestinian people, specifically the Palestinian people, as well as other people under occupation, to take up arms against the occupation. It's enshrined in UN General Assembly motions and in international law. So, you know, the idea that there shouldn't be a right to resistance is antithetical to international human law, and it shows that this is an organisation which is there to pursue Zionist interests. It's the Zionists who don't want there to be resistance, and preeminently it's them who don't want that. So any time an organisation comes up and says, well, the resistance are bad because they do this, that and the other, no, we shouldn't be having that anymore, especially not after we've seen a year and a half of genocide. We see every single day the awful things which the Zionists are doing there. It's no longer any good to talk about this and to be lily-livered about it, if you like. These are Zionist talking points, and we should be identifying them as such.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, and you mentioned the UN General Assembly. I mean, they are absolutely explicit, aren't they, about the right to armed resistance? I mean, it's very clear in them.
People under occupation have the right to resist, including armed struggle. They say the words armed struggle in the resolution. So, yeah, it's perfectly clear, yes.
No, indeed. Well, Mick, I mean, as the founder of the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, I mean, what do you think's happening with your counterparts in the London PSC office who seem to be pushing the mod so hard?
I mean, we grew up in splendid isolation up here over the last 25 years in this little parish in the north. And the ad hoc group that initially responded to the First Intifada by becoming active in educating people, what were we going to call ourselves? We didn't even know there was a PSC in London. It was at a very low ebb. And I had been active in the VSC, the Vietnam Solidarity Campaign. So we took away the V and put in a P, and we followed that model of support for liberation of a colonial people, support for that resistance against the militarism of the Americans, and the idea of building a solidarity movement that would bring together the anti-colonial resistance with people around the world who would see themselves not as kind of, looking at it from outside, but would see themselves as an extension. Now, I mean, so we're very different organisations. I have seen people in the past, over a few people over the years, who've said you can't have a meeting without a Jewish speaker. Some really weird people who, it turns out, are very timid indeed and afraid to stand their ground, who say, get me a Jewish speaker. And it's pretty pathetic sometimes and quite insulting to your Jewish comrades who are hardcore anti-Zionists. Yes. So I suspect it's timidity looking for somebody to push to the front to say, look, we don't really go too far from British foreign policy.
Yeah, indeed. Well, David, what do you know about this, what's his name, Eli Ovitz, the CEO of this Limud festival, for which Trevor Chin's also a key funder, isn't he?
Well, I mean, all the way through the Zionist movement in this country and in every other country where the Zionist movement is organised, there are people who have been on active service in the so-called IDF. And all the way through the Zionist movement, there are those who are using their charitable organisations and their companies to raise money to send to the so-called IDF, to the settlements. So this is a guy who, you know, yeah, of course, he's a reservist, can be recalled at any time. And let's remember, something like, we think, 3,000 British citizens have fought with the IDF in Gaza or in the rest of occupied Palestine in the last year and a half. So this is absolutely par for the course. Limud, of course, let me just be clear, is a Zionist organization. It poses as a nice, friendly, cultural organization, just like JW3, which is where it's based quite often, which is the Jewish Community Center in Northwest London, which of course also is famously Zionist, and is including, of course, funding by people from people like Trevor Chin. Trevor Chin, of course, as we've said many times in this program, is effectively the leader of the British Zionist movement. He's been at the head of the Union Action Jewish Israel Appeal, which is the main charity body raising funds for Zionism in this country for decades, I mean literally decades, and of course he's a massive funder of the Labour Party, including, of course, secretly funding Keir Starmer. Just information about that, of course, just released after it was too late. They thought we were voting for him. And of course, he then joined the Labour Party as a staff member in Keir Starmer's first meeting with the rest of the Israel lobby. So this is a guy who's extremely serious and pulls a lot of the strings within the British Zionist movement, and is at the leadership of that organisation and has many other charitable roles, i.e., in supporting the genocide.
Sure. Well, Nick, I mean, why do you think Nomad mobilised against David Miller? I mean, I guess the answer's probably obvious, but what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, what's not to mobilise against? David won a stunning victory to protect, which does protect everybody in their jobs to some degree, in distinguishing between the crimes of Zionism and distinguishing between Zionism and Jewishness and Judaism. So that's unforgivable, because the essence of Zionism, an axiom of Zionism, even before they chose to fall upon the people of Palestine, even when they were discussing Uganda, Patagonia, etc., Madagascar, the axiom was that Jews could not live among others as a minority, had to leave Europe and fall upon some people and colonize them. So to distinguish, to repudiate Zionism completely, is unacceptable to Nomad. It's unacceptable to people who are trying against every day's news headline to straddle the divide between support for Israel in some way and the grotesque crimes of that state. Today, 115 medical workers were assassinated, shot in the back of the head, and it seems with their hands tied behind their back. This is Israel, and this is the picture that the world has now absorbed to a huge extent. If you're trying to maintain any kind of link to that genocidal entity, then you're going to fight somebody who says not that there was a fall from grace in 1967, but it was a genocide. It had an inbuilt tendency to genocide and a settler colonial project from its very inception.
Sure.
You can't bridge that gulf. So, of course, they're going to go for every anti-Zionist without exception. And David's victory was extremely prominent and valuable to all of us.
Indeed it was. Well, our next report looks at the role played by a key Zionist think tank in delegitimising support for Palestine and criticism of Israel.
Nomad was quick to condemn the October 7th Al-Aqsa flood as terrorism and a war crime. It also has called for the unconditional release of what it calls all Israeli hostages. When considering the focus of the organization on trying to draw in supporters of Palestinians and Palestinians specifically to its vicinity, it terms to represent a form of strategic engagement, which a key Zionist think tank suggested to deal with delegitimization over a decade ago. The Root Institute was founded in 2004, and its first client was Israel's National Security Council. The think tank asserts that it was established to serve Israeli government agencies and decision makers, from top-ranking politicians to government professionals who hold positions of authority, leadership, or influence. It proudly carries out these services for Israeli government agencies free of charge, though it is handsomely funded by a network of Zionist billionaires. The Root Institute released an introductory video listing the following Israeli government agencies as clients: the Bureau of the Prime Minister, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Ministry of Finance, the Ministry of Defense, the Ministry of Industry, Trade and Labor, the IDF, the National Economic Council, and the aforementioned National Security Council. Over a decade ago, the Root Institute published a paper defining London as a hub for delegitimization of Israel. The group put forth a two-pronged strategy for dealing with what it termed, on one hand, delegitimizers, and on the other hand, criticizers. Delegitimizers were to be shut down at every opportunity, with venues that host them harassed until cancellation. On the other hand, critics were to be allowed to exist, but be targeted by what Root terms strategic engagement strategies to drag them in the direction of accepting Zionism, even if only partially. The question must be asked, is Na'amad a form of strategic engagement to facilitate normalization by stealth based on the Root Institute model?
David, what do you make of this Root Institute that just referred to in the film there?
Well, I mean, as the film was suggesting, they've been doing all this work for the Zionist regime. And they did this famous report, as the film mentions, the London is a hub of delegitimization report, which has been extremely influential throughout the Zionist movement, not just in relation to an organization like Na'amad, but the whole Zionist movement. So, and that strategy they've adopted to distinguish between the criticizers, which you might say would include someone like Na'amad, and sometimes people who are a bit more radical than Na'amad as well. I mean, PSC would be included in that, and other Stop the War probably is part of that, who are not fundamentally opposed to the existence of the State of Israel, which of course any proper anti-Zionist is. So they want to make a distinction between those who are delegitimizers, who believe that that there's no legitimacy to the Jewish state, to the State of Israel, and it must be dismantled, and those who are just a bit concerned about apartheid or the occupation or human rights or even genocide. I mean, they're concerned about genocide, but they don't want to actually deal with having to solve the problem of genocide. And the only way to solve the problem of genocide, as everybody can see, is to abolish Zionism and to dismantle the Zionist state. So it's a strategy which has been adopted across the whole of the Zionist movement, and you can really place almost every Zionist organization on some kind of continuum, how close they are to being criticizers, and how close they are to being in the home domain of Zionism.
Indeed. Well, Nick, I mean, it seems the Root Institute labelled London then, as we heard in the film there, as the hub of delegitimization. I mean, how does that make you feel in Scotland?
I feel great. We dined out for a very long time on the Israeli diplomats who told Haaretz that every visit to Scotland was like a visit, quote, to enemy territory. That's the position we wish to try to defend going forward. But, you know, when Palestine Action come into the field and we slip down the league from near the top, we're delighted. And I think in many ways London is the hub of delegitimization. You have 1 million people marching through London. We haven't achieved that kind of ratio up here. That would be about 100,000. We've not come near it. So, yeah, London has achieved a lot. But, you know, I think the real, I mean, what your introduction and what David has said is absolutely true. You've kind of removed the need to add much to it. But Reut and other, especially Reut, but other institutions have concluded that Israel is indefensible, that you don't want to talk about what Israel is doing. I mean, way back 20 years ago, the EU conducted an opinion poll, and some poor junior accidentally included Israel in the poll, and it came top across the whole of Europe. Citizens thought that it was the major threat to world peace, or more of them thought Israel was a major threat to world peace than any other country. So Israel looked at that and recognized it as a profound crisis in terms of hostility. So you can't simply stand your ground and defend Israel. What you have to do is divide and rule, is win over some people to a soft or very muted opposition, and isolate those who refuse to be to be put in that camp. So for years, we've been accused of Holocaust denial, anti-Semitism, support for terrorism. I don't know what that is. It's just a constant rain. But other softer groups don't come in for the same treatment. So it's an attempt to divide and rule. That's part of the DNA of Zionism, inside Palestine and out. Yeah. And who's surprised? You can't defend the project called Zionism and what Israel does, so you have to try and split the opposition in order to weaken it.
So I suppose the inescapable conclusion then, David, is that Namad is part of this sort of strategic engagement idea aimed at criticism of Zionism.
Well, the Zionist movement, since its very beginning, since the beginning of the post-existence of occupied Palestine, so when they created this state in 1948, they had their first Zionist Congress, World Zionist Congress, in Jerusalem in 1951, I think it was. And that's when they created the mission statement of the Zionist movement. And the mission statement included spreading Zionist ideas all over the world. I mean, it's perfectly clear that that's what they were doing. And that, of course, is the role of the Zionist movement. So when it comes to trying to influence people who are critical of Zionism, they have to have organizations who seem like they're more sympathetic or more liberal Zionists. People even who say that they're non-Zionist, and some who say they're anti-Zionist. Now, not all of those who say that they're anti-Zionist are anti-Zionist in any kind of material or straightforward way. And that's of course, the difficulty is that some people, even they might even believe that they're anti-Zionist, but they're not really anti-Zionist. And that's partly a question of a sort of penetration strategy by the Zionist movement. And Namad clearly is part of that strategy. Now, everyone in Namad might not know that. They might not believe that. But that's the purpose of Namad. It's to try and isolate those who are sort of more thoroughgoingly anti-Zionist from those who are a bit more questionable.
No, indeed. Well, Mick, I assume that PSC Scotland's not going to be platforming Namad anytime soon then.
People carry in their heads strange ideas. I mean, some people still think Columbus discovered America. They don't. They're not hardcore racists. We're perfectly ready to engage with people if they have, you know, backward ideas. But it depends on the direction they're moving in. If people are breaking from Zionism and moving, however stumblingly, however with whatever difficulty, towards support for Palestinian rights and freedom and abandoning Jewish supremacy, then we'd be delighted to engage with them. But if they're dug in and trying to bring other people towards these positions of not criticizing Zionism root and branch, then I don't see any possibility for serious engagement. But yes, we'd be happy to engage with them in order to see who among them was prepared to make the final step towards repudiating Zionism. Look, many of us have had to repudiate reactionary ideas. I know people who grow up in all sorts of backgrounds. We had to repudiate the idea that Churchill was anything other than a rancid racist, or that the British Empire was endless pillage and massacre and conquest. We had to break from those ideas. Yeah. So nobody's exempt from that. But if people are not prepared to, and I'll engage with people who are moving away from those ideas, but if they're promoting ideas that the British Empire was justified in pillaging the world, there's nothing to discuss. Mm. And it's the same with Namad. If they're dug in any way defending the genocidal state, Israel has a right to exist, blah, 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 then what's to discuss?
Yeah, well, indeed. Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. So a special thank you to our guest, Mick Napier. And thanks, of course, to our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Until next time, when I hope you'll join us again on Palestine Declassified, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now. We'll be right back.
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is Arabi English Radio. Please log on to our website at iranradio.ir. iranradio.ir.
In the limelight.
President Trump has demanded that France free its far-right politician Marine Le Pen and claimed that she is facing a witch hunt in France. Marine Le Pen has been banned from standing for the French presidency for 5 years. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Independent has covered the story and tells us more. President Trump has demanded that France free its far-right leader Marine Le Pen, as he labelled her ban from running for office a witch hunt. Marine Le Pen was found guilty of embezzling European Union funds to pay party staff in a court ruling in Paris earlier this week. The National Rally leader, once a front-runner in the polls for France's 2027 presidential election, has now been banned from standing for presidential elections, having been handed a 4-year prison sentence, 2 years of which will be served under house arrest and the other 2 suspended. Marine Le Pen denied all the charges against her. Taking to his social media platform Truth Social, U.S. President Donald Trump described the court case as another example of European leftists using lawfare to silence free speech and censor their political opponent, this time going so far as to put that opponent in prison. The 56-year-old far-right leader of France, Marine Le Pen, the leader of France's National Rally Party, set up as the National Front by her father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, in 1972, was also fined $100,000 by the court. Although the ban from public office begins immediately, the jail sentence and fine will only be confirmed once Le Pen has exhausted her appeals against the ruling. Earlier this week, Donald Trump compared himself to Marine Le Pen, describing her ban from holding public office in France as a very big deal and likening it to his own experience with the courts of law in the United States. French judge Bénédicte de Pertuis said Le Pen's actions had amounted to a serious and lasting attack on the rules of democratic life in Europe, but especially in France. Marine Le Pen stormed out of the court midway through the verdict on Monday. She was driven away from the courthouse before later taking part in a television interview in which she decried the court ruling as a political decision and claimed that the rule of law had been completely violated. Marine Le Pen is the latest in a series of European hardline politicians for whom Donald Trump has expressed support, including figures in Romania, Hungary, and Germany's far-right AfD party. The French national broadcaster France 24, France 24, has also covered the same story. U.S. President Donald Trump, his vice president J.D. Vance, and billionaire backer Elon Musk have all voiced their support for French far-right politician Marine Le Pen after she was found guilty of embezzlement and barred from running for public office in France, particularly the 2027 presidential election. Donald Trump, who often labeled his own legal woes as a leftist witch hunt, drew parallels with Marine Le Pen, the leader of France's far-right National Rally. Le Pen was widely seen as a plausible presidential winner. She was convicted last Monday of misappropriating European Union funds by using the money to pay party officials. She received a 4-year prison sentence, 2 of which are suspended, and 2 of which to be served under home detention. She also received a 100,000 euro fine. She also received an immediate 5-year ban on running for public office in France that will prevent her from running for the 2027 presidential election, unless the court ruling is overturned next year. The witch hunt against Marine Le Pen is another example of European leftists using lawfare to silence free speech and censor their political opponents, Donald Trump wrote on his Truth Social platform. He added, "It is the same playbook that was used against me." Donald Trump was indicted for covering up a hush money payment to a film star for attempts to overturn the results of the 2020 election that he lost, and for retaining classified documents after he left the White House. He was convicted in the hush money case. He denied wrongdoing in all cases and has called them politically motivated. Federal charges against him were dropped following the 2024 election win. U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance, who has accused European nations of democratic abuses by seeking to block far-right parties from office, also weighed in to support Marine Le Pen. J.D. Vance, the U.S. Vice President, said, "The Europeans, they're absolutely 100% our friends, but that relationship, it's going to get stressed and it's going to get tested if they keep on trying to throw opposition leaders in jail." Speaking to Newsmax on Thursday, 3rd of April, J.D. Vance said, "Our relationship with Europe is going to get stressed." Meanwhile, Elon Musk, who has lent his support for far-right figures across Europe, reposted Donald Trump's message on his own ex social media platform, writing, "Free Marine Le Pen." The expressions of support for Le Pen by Washington's 3 most powerful figures underline a growing divergence between the United States and other nations including many European nations, over how judges adjudicate thorny constitutional questions or wrongdoing by politicians. Marine Le Pen has accused France's judiciary of sparking a democratic crisis by barring her from the 2027 presidential election, and called for a mass protest in Paris on Sunday, although there are signs her attacks on judges are playing badly with French voters. Having previously said she backed lifetime ineligibility for politicians convicted of misappropriations of public funds, she said in an interview with Le Parisien newspaper on Wednesday that the charges against her were different.
The spacious palace with white stones surrounded by trees and green grass is the Levadia Palace. It is located in and was once the home of the last Russian Tsar, but is now the residence of a U.S. delegation. Today is February 4, 1945. In this 116-room palace, three powerful countries are supposed to gather together and discuss an important issue. The flags of the three countries have been hoisted. The troops are all ready for a military reception. Everything is ready, and the ceremonial automobile enters the premises. The first guest is a 71-year-old man. He has a strange addiction to his Cuban cigars. British Prime Minister Winston Churchill. It doesn't take long for Joseph Stalin, the host of this major meeting, to arrive. Stalin is a 65-year-old short man with a thin mustache. His first official mission was to organize government and military files. He is now going to sit at this round table and decide about the fate of the world as the leader of the Soviet Union. But the third chair belongs to Franklin Roosevelt. The New York Times wrote about his first 100 days in office as president. He takes power like a dictator. Paralyzed from the waist down due to polio when he was young, Roosevelt could hardly stand on his own two feet without help. However, he has come to this meeting as the head of one of three powerful countries. The theme of the meeting is the future of the world after the Second World War. Adolf Hitler, leader of Nazi Germany, with his trademark mustache, greatly disturbed the UK, the US, and the Soviet Union for his territorial expansion dreams after grabbing power. They had to stand up against him so that their powers in the world would not be debilitated. The alliance of the trio states against Germany achieved the predicted results in World War II. After these three superpowers got involved in the war, the German Nazis' wings were clipped and paved the way for Allied nations to enter this huge palace. They're supposed to talk about the defeat of Nazi Germany and share their achievements from the war. 8 days later, while the three major leaders are standing in front of the cameras, no one knows what lies behind the smiles of the three commanders. Their words are going to change the future of the world. And this story is not an ordinary story. It is a complex story about the future of the largest military organization in the world today, NATO. It was the 28th of July, 1914, when the First World War broke out. Amid the news of the destruction of cities in the war, some news has gone viral among the people. The world's first communist country was born. The country is called the Soviet Union. People in the world have not yet gotten used to the name of this large country when the International Communist Organization is formed with the aim of making the world communist. A great fear arises among the European powers. By now, everyone has understood that communism intends to form a classless society whose economy is controlled by the government and its citizens are under the scrutiny of the government. They have no other goal than to serve the society. Just opposite to the capitalist system that is the dominant mindset of Western countries these days. In order to achieve maximum profit, the capitalist system bases the society's administration on free elections and manages the economy, production, and agriculture by private individuals. So it is a serious opponent of communism. These two views will remain in opposition to each other until Germany becomes the dominant power in the world. For this man with his toothbrush mustache, the dream of territorial expansion is not something that would bring Soviet communists and Western capitalists under a united flag. Ideological differences between the two gradually fade away. But just when everything is in place to create a front against the Germans, the UK and France refuse to agree. They do not trust the communists who intend to bring the world under their banner. The Soviet leader is annoyed by this hesitation. Ever since he chose the Russian name Stalin for himself, he became known as Iron Man. An Iron Man who knows very well what decision to make for the communists in critical moments. August 1939, some news spreads in the world. The news shocks the West much more than the news of the destruction of cities in the First World War. The Soviet Union and Germany reach an agreement. The text of the agreement, which is signed on the non-aggression of both countries and the division of Eastern Europe between them, War II. On September 1, 1939, Germany invaded Poland. Everything is going according to the agreement by the two countries, but on June 22, 1941, Hitler orders a massive attack against Soviet territories. An attack that is referred to as the largest and most extensive military attack. Stalin feels completely desperate. He has no choice but to fight the Germans. He now pivots to the West. Stalin desperately needs their help to succeed in the war. Germany's advance in the war scared Roosevelt and Churchill, so they get on board to negotiate with Stalin. However, they're still worried about the consequences of their move. Will Stalin remain loyal to them? No one knows. The only thing they are sure about is the danger of the German army's massive penetration in Europe. Roosevelt and Churchill make their decision. They extend a hand of friendship to Stalin. The private meetings where Roosevelt and Churchill call Stalin Uncle Joe for more intimacy. After news about the alliance spreads around the world, some believe that they have put aside their political differences. But no one knows that heads of these three countries themselves have no decision for this. They get together in their meetings and drink and dine and take photos in honor of one another. But in their minds, they dream and fantasize about defeating each other. The alliance takes its toll on Germany. Hitler is the loser of the war. The US, the UK, and the Soviet Union are the winners. Now they have to sit and once again discuss the spoils of war, of which European territory is the main one. The city of Potsdam will host the Allied states once again. The Allied states that have experienced changes in the past few months. President Roosevelt has passed away. People in the US will replace Roosevelt with his first vice president, Harry Truman.
Scene 2144A.
The inexperienced Truman is sent to Potsdam Conference as the chief negotiator. Americans now know Stalin better. After their new president meets him, they become emboldened and nicknamed the Soviet leader, the Little Bud. Although the Soviet government managed to expand its borders a few hundred kilometers to the west and establish its dependent regimes throughout Eastern Europe, not all countries under its influence have yet become communist. The US and UK have repeatedly asked the Soviet Union to hold free elections in the Baltic states, Poland, and other parts of Eastern Europe, but the communist dictator refrained from taking any practical step. Stalin makes his decision. The devastating Soviet losses in the war have made Stalin unable to flex its muscles. He needs to take prudent steps. He makes his decision. The Westerners' wish for elections is fulfilled, but the Eastern European countries will have to hold an election whose leaders are acceptable to the Soviet government. But Stalin is facing a big problem to implement this policy. Some European countries, like Poland, do not like communism. They have never forgotten the memory of Hitler's attack and Stalin's initial support for them in 1939. In Poland, Stalin has no choice but to impose his puppet government on them, otherwise Poland will slip out of his control. But it not only made Poland hate communism even more, but also made Stalin's allies, namely the US and UK, doubtful. Their hesitation did not go away even until 2 weeks before Roosevelt's death. Roosevelt believes that Stalin will not fulfill any of the promises he made for peace between European countries. At that time, if Roosevelt knew he would not live long enough to participate in the Potsdam Conference, he would have given his first Vice President Truman some advice about Stalin. In 1946, the Soviet Intelligence Service, which was assigned by Stalin to spy, gained access to a long and secret telegram. The telegram was from a young officer at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, George F. Keenan. Stalin checks the telegram in detail. It seems to be an important telegram. The more he scrutinizes it, the less he is successful in seeing a solution from the U.S. In the letter, Keenan reports to his authorities, Soviet leaders are forced to treat the outside world as a hostile world because this is the only excuse for a dictatorship without which they did not know how to rule. There will be no change in the Soviet Union's strategy until it has suffered a long enough streak of defeats to convince the future leader of the Kremlin that Soviet behavior is not in their interests. There is no need for war to achieve this result. Stalin is completely confused. How is the U.S. going to face the Soviet Union this time? In June 1947, Truman designated the sullen military man George Marshall as his Secretary of State. Marshall, one of the commanders of World War II, who received the title of the Designer of Victory from Churchill due to his management, proposed a solution for this problem. The United States should commit to rebuilding post-war Europe with economic aid. Stalin knows better than anyone what reconstruction means. Little by little, with the implementation of the Marshall Plan in Western Europe, the ideological frameworks of communism start shaking. The financial guarantees provided by the U.S. aid enabled Western European governments to begin building their modern welfare states. The working class in European countries who are enjoying a better lifestyle completely forget communism. September 1947, Stalin finally steps in.
Leaders of the party and government, representatives of the various Soviet republics, and of the Communist and Workers' Party.
The Cominform, or the pre-war International Communist Organization, is what Stalin has been thinking about for a while. Stalin believed when the goal of the Cominform became loyalty to the main principles in the international communist movement, the space for freedom of opinion among Europeans would become narrower. Now it is Truman's turn to act against Stalin. He checks all the options. The problem has only one solution.